This is the Airplane Geeks Podcast. Our aim is to educate and inform you, explore and expand your passion for aviation, and entertain you a little along the way. This episode, we have interviews at the Museum of Flight in Seattle, Washington. We speak with the CEO of the museum, the curator for space history, and the director of collections. In the news, some think the new Boeing NMA, or 797 if you prefer, could have only one pilot. We see some large airline deals in Canada. Ryanair's Michael O'Leary sees more European airline failures this year. A cryogenic hydrogen fuel cell for an all-electric aircraft. The American Airlines app that lets you sign up to get bumped. United Airlines promotes women artists. Two U.S. fighters get special paint jobs. And we should be seeing an Air Force Aggressor squadron with F-35As. All that and more coming up right now. Welcome to the Airplane Geeks Podcast. This is episode 553 of the show where we talk aviation. I'm Max Flight, and joining me is first David Vanderhoof, our aviation historian.
Hi, everyone. Looking forward to a good week. Looks like summer has arrived. We skipped spring again here. It was like 89 degrees here today. But I'm looking forward to a good show tonight with my two favorite Maxes.
Yay.
I don't know if I have a third, but we'll go on from there.
If you had named your new pet fish Max, then that would have been really impressive. Then you could have said three.
No, I named him Zeke, but we can talk about Zeke later in his P-40.
Okay. Also joining us is Max Trescott. He's host of Aviation News Talk podcast. He's the 2008 CFI of the Year. And of course, he's an expert on learning to fly or purchase a Cirrus aircraft. Hey, Max.
Hello, Max and David, and I'm so disappointed. I don't have any fish and none of my pets are named Zeke, but I think that sounds really cool.
Well, the only thing I'm allowed to have that's a real size pet in this apartment is a cat, and I'm allergic, and I don't really want to pay the extra $100+ a month to support the cat in rent, and not counting food, litter boxes, etc. So a fish it is.
A fish it is.
I just hope Zeke doesn't get shot down.
There'll be a picture of Zeke in the show notes.
Sounds good.
All right. Hey, guys, let's jump right in with some of the aviation news from the past week. Is everybody ready?
Ready.
Ready from the West.
Our first item comes from CNBC. Boeing's new 797 could be built to fly with just one pilot on board. The new mid-sized airplane, the NMA, which some people are calling the 797, is understood to be a clean sheet of paper design. And some analysts, notably those from Jefferies, which is a multinational investment bank and financial services company, Jefferies, they asked airline and leasing company executives what they wanted to see in the new NMA. And Max Trescott, what did they say?
Well, first of all, I have to point out that this photograph that accompanies the article looks like it might be a Cessna 182 cockpit. It's definitely not a Boeing cockpit of any kind. That is the Garmin G1000 that I see there. Though the pilot does have three stripes on her shoulder, so there is some connection there. Well, I'll tell you, the thing that really struck me is, you know, most interesting about this, you know, this is actual strong speculation that this could be a single pilot aircraft. And, you know, we've heard that bandied about for years, but that's the first time I remember it actually being associated with a particular aircraft design.
Yeah, they say that with one pilot on board, you'd still have a second ground-based pilot, but one that is maybe serving multiple aircraft. One of the things we've heard in the past is that this was most likely to start on a cargo aircraft rather than on a passenger aircraft. I think that was something that I think many of us assumed would be the case. Now, I don't know that the NMA, the 797, or whatever Boeing officially ends up calling it, which, by the way, probably will not be something with a MAX suffix, I assume, whether or not that's the first one that actually has, the first plane that actually has only one pilot, or if the idea here is they're going to design it with that in mind so that when that becomes possible in the future and when it becomes acceptable to passengers, they could make that switch. I don't know. It's kind of hard to say.
I think they're one step away from optionally manned. Let's just go all the way.
Great.
Seriously, it probably could be. I mean, an aircraft that's being designed now or is scheduled or slated to possibly be to start being designed now could have that in mind, and it's probably not a big leap. I think the biggest leap is public acceptance.
Of course, yeah. The thing that really surprised me about this was they said that this aircraft, they see it as typically serving transatlantic routes. And I was thinking, holy cow, that's a really long time for a single pilot to be up there in the cockpit. Now, I'm guessing for really long trips like that, there would be a relief crew. So there might be two pilots, but they would be, you know, switching, you know, back and forth between the rest area and the cockpit. But that's just a heck of a long time to be sitting up there by yourself. I just kind of wonder, boy, will that, will people get bored and will they be playing video games to stay awake? I mean, I can tell you that for lots of long trips that I've done, when there are two of us in the cockpit, I always feel much lower levels of stress because I know that if I overlook something, there's a high probability that pilot number two will, you know, catch what it is. If it's just me up there, stress levels are just a little bit more elevated because I'm, you know, constantly fretting a little bit about, ooh, will I overlook something or will I miss something? And I would just imagine that pilots in general would probably enjoy, you know, having somebody else up in the cockpit, you know, more often than not. I mean, there'd be times when they don't particularly like the person they're with, but still, I think, you know, except in extreme cases, that's probably preferable to, you know, to being alone up there. So I would imagine even pilots, you know, let alone passengers, are probably not, you know, real keen on the idea. On the other hand, I've said for a long time that I think that this probably is ultimately the solution to the pilot shortage that we've been talking about for years and years and years. When you look at the number of pilots that Boeing predicts is going to be needed over the next 20 years, it's hard to imagine where we're going to find all that pilots unless we do go to single pilot cockpits.
Do you have a time where you don't have any problem flying solo for X amount of time, but beyond that, it then starts getting comfortable? Do you have like a set limit? I know in my life, it used to be that 3 hours was really comfortable for me to drive by myself. 6 hours was kind of pushing it. Anything beyond that, I wanted somebody with me. When you're flying solo, do you have a window that you mentally go, you know, I really think I need somebody with me just for whatever reason?
Yeah, the number that kind of popped in my mind was kind of 2 hours in terms of the, you know, if it's a 2 hour flight, man, you're busy enough that, you know, keep you occupied. It starts getting longer than that. Now you got really kind of long stretches of not a lot to do. And yeah, that starts to get a little bit boring. And I have often, you know, brought my music along with me, and that kind of keeps me, you know, relaxed and kind of still, you know, in the game, if you will. I can't imagine a really, really long, you know, 8 hour flight with, you know, the sun streaming in through the cockpit late in the day. You're tired. You had a short night. I mean, holy cow. That to me is a perfect setup for a single pilot to fall asleep in the cockpit.
And folks, if you send an email to Aviation News Talk, Max Trescott will provide his flying playlist, because I'm really curious what that is. But I'm behind the scenes, so I can't send that email.
That's funny. Yeah, greatest hits for flying solo.
Yeah. Now, the speculation had been that the new mid-sized airplane might be officially launched at the Paris Air Show in June. But almost everybody in the aviation press is saying, and this makes sense, I think, is that with the, if you want to call it, distraction of the 737 MAX, that that's likely to be delayed. Certainly management attention is focused on the 737 MAX and getting that back up in the air. And that's almost certainly going to have an impact on their ability to proceed with getting authorization from the board of directors for the NMA. Interestingly, and kind of related to that, is that as far as the engine competitors, in February, Rolls-Royce dropped out, leaving just CFM International and Pratt and Whitney. Rolls said that they were, quote, unable to commit to the proposed timetable. I wonder if there's a push out of the NMA to any significant degree, if that changes the position from Rolls-Royce. Don't know. But at least as of right now, it looks like a competition between just two engine makers. And I actually don't know if Boeing is expecting to sole source this or to offer an engine option. That's always an interesting aspect to these things.
Well, let's talk about the timeline on something like this. They were talking about rolling this out in potentially, 9 or 10 years? 2028, so that's 9 years away. What would you estimate would be the time frame in which, you know, someone like Rolls would have had to have the new engine available for this kind of aircraft?
I would think that would be enough time. Although certainly engines would have to be produced for the certification and the flight test program in advance of that by a couple of years. But that's still an awful lot of time, especially if it's a derivative engine. So, yeah, I don't know. Three competitors is tough. That's three companies spending an awful lot of money, and like billions. It's a tough thing to swallow. Rolls has other issues. They're working now, I think, with some other engines. And that may be the real reason why they don't want to divert any of their resources to some future program. But not every engine maker is on every airplane, certainly, because, you couldn't all afford that anyway. We have two now, but, you know, we'll see what happens.
That's kind of interesting. So on a 9-year program, they really can wait until just 2 years before it goes into entry to have their final product ready?
Of course, you've got to be in the development process long before that. You're spending a lot of development dollars, so you've got negative cash flow on that program for a significant number of years, which is a financial drain on the company. And so, you know, that's one reason oftentimes why you'll see an engine maker drop out of a particular program or never even enter it, because, again, you can't afford to be on every airplane or develop a prototype for every airplane.
Are you talking, Max, a new engine, or are you talking a derivative engine? The Neos and the Maxes were just re-engineering airframes. What kind of strategy do you put an existing engine on a new airframe, or do you try to go all out and go and try to make the next step and put a fuel cell derivative turboprop on the new airframe? I'm curious what kind of thinking that would be.
Typically, what will happen is that the airframer will have pretty in-depth conversations with potential customers, airlines and leasing companies, to see what it is they want. And so the operators will be guessing at what their needs will be years into the future. And then the airframer will try to use that in their strategy when it comes to designing the aircraft, and then go to the suppliers, the subsystem suppliers, and say, hey, we need, this is what we envision, and so we need this from you in order to accomplish that. And it's kind of a dance. It's kind of a coordinated dance amongst the airframers, the customers, and the suppliers to try to come together with a solution that works for everybody. It doesn't always happen. I mean, we have, we've got the A380 as an example. Now, I wouldn't really call that a failure, but it's an example of where that dance among the different parties resulted in that aircraft that everybody thought would serve the needs of all of them. But in the end, you know, limited value to the industry. The 737 and the A320 family now, of course, are on the opposite scale. Those are designs that have been enormously successful. So you have some winners, you have some losers, and along the way, you spend a lot of money trying to get there. But all right, so let's talk about big transactions in Canada. And this is an article in Avweb. We have something called Onyx, Toronto-based Onyx, and they own Spirit Aerosystems. Of course, Spirit manufactures fuselages and wings for Boeing. They do that in Wichita and Kansas City. So Onyx has offered $31 a share for WestJet, which is the number two airline in Canada. Now, $31 a share is a pretty good price because WestJet shares had traded just a little bit over $18 a share before that offer. So the board of directors, of course, approved that deal. Not a surprise. Now, shareholders have to approve the sale also. But with that kind of valuation, why wouldn't they?
Yep. And it's kind of fun to be actually talking about Canada because I don't think we talk enough about our neighbors to the north and aviation for Canada. But it's interesting that that happened. And then almost simultaneously, Air Canada made its move. And so they're now in talks to buy Air Transat, which I was not familiar with, but it's described as a predominantly leisure market-based carrier in Montreal. And they've just offered $520 million for them. And it kind of made me wonder if we're starting to have more consolidations. Obviously, here in the U.S., that consolidation has pretty much happened. We've left with four major carriers, but it looks like maybe in Canada and other parts of the world, that is starting to happen a little bit more.
Yeah, there's some opportunities there, I think. Not anymore in the United States, like you say, I hope. I don't think anybody wants any more consolidation in the United States. Some would argue that maybe we've had a little bit too much. But in Canada and in other countries, like you say, Max, there are some opportunities.
Well, I think that ties directly to our next story, which Ryanair has said that they think there's going to be a wave of European airline failures to continue. And I think airline failures can also sometimes lead to airline mergers, as when one airline is on the ropes, they may be inclined to sell themselves, or even if they go bankrupt, suddenly all their aircraft are going to be coming available. And they end up with fewer air carriers in total. So it's kind of interesting. And in some ways, that's a similar kind of thing happening across the pond.
Right. We've seen Fly BMI fail. We've seen Wow Air, of course, and Primera. Those have all failed recently. Alitalia and Thomas Cook haven't failed, but they're up for sale. And Michael O'Leary says that he expects that we're going to see more of the same in the second half of 2019. Now, why are we seeing this? Well, the thought is that it's a combination of higher fuel costs and also fare wars. Now, some of the airlines have not hedged their fuel. O'Leary says Ryanair is 90% hedged for the rest of its financial year, fiscal year, I guess. So that protects them in times of rising fuel prices. But the margins on these low-cost carriers is pretty slim, and you have downward pressure of fares because of competition and upward pressure for costs due to fuel, and it's not a good combination.
And I thought it was really kind of interesting coincidence, perhaps, that Mr. O'Leary predicted that the European travel industry will be dominated by just four or five large airline groups within the next 5 years. You know, that's basically the number we're looking here at the U.S. So I think he's really saying that he expects almost exactly the same degree of consolidation to occur in Europe as has happened here in the U.S.
Now, Ryanair isn't doing as well this year or over the course of the last year as they had been doing. There's a piece in the Independent that indicates that for Ryanair, fares are down 6% in the past year, and profit is down 29%. So we're seeing the result of those pressures.
Get those toilets with this quarter slots in the machines.
They could come back.
Yeah.
gotta make a nickel wherever we can. New fees. Well, and just a few minutes ago, I noticed another Ryanair story, so I kind of popped it in here as well. And this relates to something that we talked about, 6 weeks ago or so, when the Boeing 737 MAX first came into the news. And we speculated then that airlines might be looking for compensation from Boeing for issues related to 737 MAXs. And this story says that Ryanair has on order 135 MAX 200 models with options for 75 more. They haven't received any of them yet. They're supposed to arrive starting in April and June of next year, but now that's been pushed out. They expect them now to show up in November because of delays associated with the 737 MAX program. And of course, they're saying, hey, you know what? Let's have a little compensation here. This is costing us money.
Ironically, profits are down and suddenly Ryan is looking for money from Boeing.
Well, it's not their fault that they're getting screwed this way.
Yeah. No, it is kind of amazing that we're dealing with this. And I
think we're going to see a lot more of this.
Well, can I say something to get something off my chest after all of these years?
What would you do if I said no?
I
think you should too.
I'm so happy that you airliner geeks finally have a story that's as annoying as a tanker. The 737 MAX is going to go on and on and on. And it was worse than any tanker story that ever was. But now that I've got that off my chest and you've been disgruntled the last 10 years, this one is going to be something we've been talking about every week because something new comes up.
Yeah, it's true. This is a story that's really going to have reverberations, as we said, in all kinds of different ways. You know, I suspect that there are going to be many airlines looking for compensation related to the 737 MAX to different degrees. I'm guessing we won't hear about most of them. I think Ryan is just, one of those has a CEO who's just out there in front telling it like it is and always, looking for a little bit of publicity. So it's probably why we're hearing them talk about this first more than other airlines. But yeah, I fully expect that everybody is having that same conversation with Boeing right now.
Yeah. I did see a lot of 737 MAX aircraft parked when I was in Seattle last week in multiple locations. They're kind of running out of space for them, I think. But, when you see that, it's heartbreaking almost.
It is.
To see all those aircraft, and a lot of them are painted with their liveries. Some are not. But still, it's just heartbreaking.
I don't think people understand assembly lines. You don't just stop an assembly line, because what's harder than stopping an assembly line?
Starting
it back up again,
Exactly.
So they've reduced the rate, but they've gone, let's see, what is it from, I don't remember. Is it like 42 to 32 or 52 to 42? Something like that. They've reduced the rate. Boeing's line is set at a monthly rate, number of aircraft per month, and they had been ramping that up on the 737 and wanted to continue to do so to meet this demand that they have. But so instead, they've ratcheted it back, which is the wrong direction from what they had originally planned.
Well, I think the biggest tragedy, obviously, are the crashes and the loss of lives.
Yes, yes.
And all these other things are kind of, in the grand scheme of things, minor, even though they have big economic impacts on everybody. I did read over the last couple of days that Boeing has announced that the the final software is now available for the MCAS system. So I think they're going to do a good job of getting it back into service quickly. And of course, the FAA has put a lot of oversight into this process. There are a lot of committees that have been going on to review with external panels of experts. The whole thing is really kind of unfortunate. I mean, it's a fantastic airplane. I don't think anything about this really undercuts the basic integrity of the airplane. It's just an incredibly unfortunate incident along the way where, I'm guessing if we look back, there were probably mistakes made. And unfortunately, there's a price that many, many folks have had to pay for that.
Yes, yes. All right, pushing on from New Atlas. And this is NASA backs development of cryogenic hydrogen system to power all electric aircraft. So we talk about electric airplanes a lot these days. Certainly, David and I do an awful lot over at the UAV Digest podcast.
No, you talk about fuel cells a lot. I just sit and listen.
Yeah, yeah, because they're actually a little, relatively small. I was going to say tiny fuel cells, but they're not really tiny, but they are fairly small, being used in unmanned aircraft, in drones. But here, we see something a little different. Now, oftentimes when we talk about electric aircraft designs, we talk about using batteries, right? A battery-powered airplane. And there are some hybrid designs that might use a fossil fuel engine to generate electricity that then operates the electric motors. Well, a hydrogen fuel cell airplane would use hydrogen to generate electricity, and with a little water is the only byproduct. So they're kind of green. Now, in the applications that David and I have talked about in the past, generally you're looking at compressed hydrogen. So you've got a hydrogen bottle, maybe something kind of similar to a scuba tank, smaller for a drone, of course, that can hold highly pressurized hydrogen. Well, here we have something a little different, liquid hydrogen. The University of Illinois Center for Cryogenic High Efficiency Electrical Technologies for Aircraft, which is CHEETA, C-H-E-E-T-A. And they have a concept for a cryogenic hydrogen fuel cell system that powers, or that would power, an all-electric aircraft. So CHEETA, there's a lot of people working on this. In fact, this project, this CHEETA project, is actually a consortium. Here's who's involved: the Air Force Research Laboratory, Boeing Research and Technology, General Electric Global Research, Ohio State University, MIT, University of Arkansas, University of Dayton Research Institute, and Rensselaer Polytechnic Institute, RPI. A lot of smart people involved in this, and they have some funding now from NASA. I think the question is, you know, why liquid hydrogen instead of just highly compressed hydrogen? I guess one thing is that the tank could be smaller. I mean, it would have the same mass, I would guess, whether it's just highly compressed gas or whether it's liquid hydrogen. But one kind of side benefit, if you will, is that with liquid hydrogen, you could use that for superconducting energy transmission. So you might get some efficiencies that you wouldn't have from just highly compressed hydrogen.
I would think that liquid would be easier to use at an airport. You know, just fill up the tanks and away you go. Whereas you might have to compress the tanks. And you know, I don't know if the logistics behind the compressed is easier than using the liquid.
Yeah, that's an interesting point. Because if you have a reservoir of hydrogen, I think you probably wouldn't store it. Boy, am I getting out of my comfort zone here. I imagine you wouldn't store it highly compressed, but that would infer that you need a compressor, like you say, David, in order to fill the tanks, as it were.
Well, look at what you need to do when you launch a rocket with all the venting of the gases when you're compressing all of that stuff. I mean, anybody who watches a rocket launch these days watches, you know, they got to turn off keep the pressures up. So it's interesting. I also like the fact that they're looking for a blended wing body to handle all of this stuff. But the most important thing is, it's green.
Yeah.
Besides being a technology, it's a green technology. And it's, I wouldn't say a non-mature technology, because liquid hydrogen is one of the ways that they use on the station to power the International Space Station. So when it gives off oxygen, hey, look at that. You need that to breathe. I joke about you being fuel cell, but I kind of like pay attention in the background. So it's kind of a really cool thought. You know, you've got an infrastructure where you've got tanks loaded with gasoline at an airport. Maybe one or two of those tanks no longer have jet fuel, but have liquid hydrogen. You pull up the, and then you have the tanker truck run across the airport and fill up the airplane. Away you go. And environmentally, how bad can it be?
Yeah, yeah. I think we're probably a number of years away from practical applications of this, but hopefully maybe sometime in the next, 5 years, we'll see some kind of a concept demonstrator that might indicate whether or not this technology has really true practical applicability. But I think it's something that obviously a lot of companies, a lot of universities, a lot of organizations are working very hard to develop.
So since this is Get Something Off Our Chest episode today, could I get something off my chest?
Uh-oh.
Uh-oh.
I know.
This is a hydrogen aircraft. What possibly could go wrong?
Yeah.
Are you saying you're Hindenburging this article?
No, I'm just, yeah. I mean, obviously, that's always a consideration. You have something that's that volatile, and I guess it's going to be probably safer in liquid form than in gaseous form. But still, it kind of begs the question, hey, is this going to be as safe as other fuels in an aircraft? And I don't know.
How often have you driven by a truck on the highway that's venting liquid oxygen or sure. liquid hydrogen? It happens all the time. If you see one of those trucks in the middle of the summer and it's got a cloud of steam coming out the back of it, it's probably liquid oxygen or liquid hydrogen. So I'd
much rather be passing a truck full of liquid oxygen than full of liquid hydrogen.
Well, I'm not so sure, but
I agree.
Liquid oxygen is
nasty stuff as well.
That's nasty as well. Yes. So we'll see, obviously. And changing the, the distribution system from avgas to hydrogen, liquid or otherwise, that's a big move. I mean, look how difficult it's become to this change to biofuels, right? But hopefully we'll get there. But I think it'll take a long time.
Can I also give out a shout out to NASA this week for all of our space geeks out there?
Sure.
NASA announced that they're going to put a woman on the moon. And I love the new name of the new lunar space program from NASA.
Now, wait a minute. That woman's name is not Alice, right?
No. Well, yeah. One of these days, pow.
Not the Honeymooners and Jack Gleason. To the moon, Alice, to the moon.
You've got to be pretty old to understand that that reference there.
And being an antiquities geek, their choice of name for the mission is really cool. Apollo took us to the moon.
Right.
Apollo had a twin sister.
Oh.
The new mission is going to be called Artemis, which was Apollo's twin sister, and Artemis will be taking the first woman to the moon.
Oh.
As Apollo took the first man. So now a lot's going to happen, a lot of money, but it is kind of cool that the next space program is going to be called Artemis and to follow Apollo. And so shout out to all those air, I do pay attention to space stuff too, folks, and antiquities, but Artemis is a really cool name. I'm happy to see someone in NASA thought that one out. So
there's some good thinking. All right, back here on Earth, American Airlines, Travel Pulse has an article. Boy, I tell you, this Travel Pulse website, it really assaults you with ads. But we've done that for you. And what we see here is American Airlines app instantly compensates bumped passengers. Now, American, as well as Delta and United, already lets you volunteer for the bump list through their apps. But now American is apparently the first that will award compensation right through the app. This is pretty convenient.
Definitely. Yeah, I think this makes it really convenient. You don't have to go very far back in the news to remember some pretty bad publicity that United got with bumping a passenger. And here, of course, this can all happen before people board the aircraft. And they get compensated right there on the spot. And what really surprised me is the app also allows you to pick a replacement flight right then and there. They really make the whole process easy.
On my Alaska Air flight back east from Seattle last week, they had overbooked. And so the gate attendant got on the PA system and asked if there were any volunteers to get bumped and they would receive some compensation. So a few people wandered up and one wanted to know what the compensation would be and what the alternatives would be. And upon hearing that, she had to get on her phone. This is while she's still standing at the front of this short line, you know, at the counter. She had to get on her phone in order to talk to her daughter, who would be meeting her, to see if she came on a later flight, if she'd still be able to. You know, this thing kind of went on and on and on. And so the whole process took quite a while. And, you know, different people were involved in that as they learned what the options were and stuff, and, you know, different customers. And you didn't know where it was going to go. If this could all be automated through an app, that seems like that would offer a lot less confusion and get to a solution a lot quicker.
That's a fabulous idea, especially when you figure that load factors right now are really high. We're coming into the summer busy travel season, and then of course we're a little shy on capacity while the 737 MAXs are still grounded. So anything that kind of helps speed the process, I think that's just great.
Yes. Now, AeronauticsOnline.com has a story. United Airlines unveils two special liveries. United says, this is kind of interesting statistic, they say that 51% of today's artists are women. Okay, that's great. But not even 13% of the art on display in museums is by women artists. I thought that was kind of amazing. So United created a contest for women artists.
Yeah, I was really surprised by that statistic as well, too. I mean, it makes sense to me that half the artists would be women, but I was shocked that less than 13% actually have their work displayed in museums. But this is such a clever idea, having a contest to come up with livery for a special kind of one-off aircraft. It's always kind of fun anytime you have an aircraft that's painted in a special way. And what a great way to do that. So there are two winners to this. There was been a winner from California and a winner from the New York, New Jersey area. And these are theme aircraft. So one of them is a California state theme, and the other one is a New York area theme. And these liveries look really great. The California theme has water and ocean and palm trees. The New York City one has looks like part of the skyline, as well as a large portion, kind of a zoom in of the Statue of Liberty. So it's going to be a lot of fun seeing these things flying around in the sky. I hope I see one of them soon.
You know, and United needs to hire these two to replace their liveries because they're getting uglier by the year. So these two people did better than the last couple of years since the Continental transition. Oh, did I say that out loud? I'm sorry, folks.
So United called this contest the Her Art Here contest. And yeah, the two winners are going to have two Boeing 757 aircraft painted in their designs. United is doing more. The winners, as well as the top finalists, are going to have their art displayed inside some United terminals. They also each receive 100,000 United Mileage Plus miles. And those two big winners, they each get a $10,000 cash prize. So that's great. This could almost be the an airline of the week, you know, positive airline story of the week.
Except we have one of those once we get to it.
I know.
But no, this is really spectacular. And the other thing is that the artwork will be available for sale in the United terminals as well, too. So, I mean, hats off to them. This was just a really well-executed promotion from start to finish. And I think it's fantastic. Very creative.
Agreed. All right, switching over to military, thedrive.com says Air Force F-16 Aggressor jet emerges in highly anticipated Ghost paint scheme. David, what's a Ghost paint scheme?
Well, there's a little background story. This dovetails perfectly off of United.
Mm-hmm.
The commander of the 57th Fighter Wing, which is based out of Nellis, the home of Red Flag, back in March decided that he was going to let Facebook paint one of the aggressors that was due for a repaint. So they did a kind of March Madness of various schemes and stuff. And finally, what came out was what's called the Ghost Scheme, which is currently on the SU-57 fifth generation Russian fighter jet, which is a pixelated blue, gray, white, kind of sexy. Originally, they were calling it the shark scheme. It kind of looks like a shark. And they went through it, and the 57th commander finally let Facebook pick this. So it's been painted, and it finally is coming out of the paint barn in this camouflage. And it's been an interesting social experiment between the military, and in this case, the 57th Fighter Wing, and the general public, or the av geeks. It's a way of the military reaching out to the general public to have let them have a say. The scheme is really pretty. Anybody who knows me, I've been in love with aggressors since when I was a little kid, and Red Flag. But there's a little bit more to the story. Actually, not to be outdone, and they sort of knew it was coming. The Navy also has aggressor squadrons, or as they would say, adversary squadrons. And the chief adversary squadron is based at Oceania, which is VFC 12, which is Fighter Composite Squadron 12, and they fly F-18 Hornets. So while the Air Force was just about getting ready to roll out their F-16 in the GOES scheme, VFC 12 in Oceania pulled out a couple of days ahead of time and went, "Oh, did we forget what we told you we were doing?" So pulled out an F-18B painted also in the GOES scheme. So not only do we have some interaction with the general public, but us military av geeks noticed there's some inter-service rivalry. And everybody, including the Russians, have got in on the game. They've commented, but there is a real sort of thing that we do this for. We do this not just for some fun, but we also do it to learn, you know, and to you train as you fight and you fight as you train. And in this case, a Top Gun, the F-16s there of the 64th currently train not only the U.S. Air Force, but also they train the Brits, the Turks, the Australians, anyone who participates in Red Flag. It's not just an American operation. And they are the bad guys. And to get experience seeing these kind of camouflages out in the range, needless to say, this GOES camouflage doesn't necessarily fit in with the Nevada desert, but somebody will get a chance to see what it looks like and get a feel for it. And it's fun to know that my choice of what I wanted to see on an aggressor is now being painted, not on one aircraft, but two, is really kind of cool. So congratulations to the 57th. But there was more news coming out of that air wing. And this was kind of surprising. About 5 years ago, there's always been the 64th and the 65th based at Nellis. Well, for a while there in the early 2000s, we actually went back to having two squadrons at Nellis, the 64th and the 65th. The 64th carried F-16Cs, which replaced their F-5s, and the 65th had F-15Cs, Eagles, to act as adversaries. So there were advanced fourth fighter generation fighter aircraft for our fifth fighter generation. Well, economics pursued, and they stood down the 65th with the F-15s because they were too expensive to operate, leaving only the 18th Aggressor Squadron, which occurs, which is part of Red Flag Alaska, which is based at Ellison, which also supplements the squadrons down at Nellis. But the 64th was the primary. Well, they just made the announcement that in the next couple of years, the 65th will be stood up again with F-35As, which is impressive because we've already come to the conclusion that the F-35 and the F-22 have been flying at Nellis in Red Flag with one hand tied behind their back, which is really not how you want to fight, nor how you want to train. So now using some early block F-35s, Now, these are F-35s that are never going to be able to be completely updated to become a frontline aircraft. That being said, their capabilities still whop any fourth generation fighter out there. So the F-22s and the F-35s will have a one-on-one competition where they don't have to tie their hands behind their back. Likewise, our allies will get access to have to fight against F-35s in combat with the Eurofighters and the Typhoons, Typhoons and the Rafales and other fourth generation or fourth plus generation aircraft. So this is a big deal. I know there was a lot of people dismissive. Well, they don't know what to do with the F-35s. Well, in all fairness, we've done things like this before. The very first block of Blue Angel F-18s, the reason why the Blue Angels got the Air First F-18As was not because they needed them, was because the Navy had a bunch of F-18As that were not carrier capable. So they were never going to be carrier capable, and they were designed as early block training aircraft. So the Blue Angels used them until they were worn out. So early block aircraft always tend to go on to special missions, etc. In this case, it's the best possible mission. Now, we were sent a question by Launchpad about paint on an F-35, and will they get their adversary paints? And the answer to my question is, I don't know. The have glass paint that is on F-35s is designed to reinforce their stealth capabilities, and they might want to downplay that. I know that the 57th Fighter Weapon Squadron posted a photograph of Photoshop, but nonetheless, of the Ghost F-16 flying on the wing of an F-35 painted like a Chinese J-10 in overall black. Yes, it looked really good. Whether they'll do that or not, I don't know, but we've got a couple of years to figure out. But a lot of things happening at Nellis, and what's really cool about it is it's a lot of things being open to the public and out in the open, and that's really kind of a nice, enjoyable thing to us military av geeks. You know, we're getting to be part of opening up things that we get to see more and more of. So I've been excited about these last couple stories over the last couple weeks.
I could tell. All right. Thanks, David.
Is this a good time for us to announce the new Airplane Geeks contest? This is the one where listeners are going to be able to submit their designs if they're aviation related, and we'll pick the winning design and it will be applied to Max East's car.
Oh, God.
It just seems only appropriate after all these, special livery stories.
I guess so. Yeah.
I had a friend who painted up his Ford as a BF-109 from World War II.
Yeah.
Wow.
So that was a Ford Special Escort, and he followed it up with a 67 Mustang painted up like a World War II Mustang with D-Day stripes and checkers on the nose, etc. So it's been done.
That's great.
I just returned from a week trip. I was in Seattle and Vancouver, Victoria, and had a great time with Isaac Alexander. Isaac even came up with a name for this. This is Max's Pacific Northwest Av Geek Adventure 2019. So we went to Viking Air, did a tour there, went to the BC Aviation Museum. We were able to get into the Air Nav Canada Victoria Harbor Tower. That was fascinating. We also went to the Vancouver Flight Center. We saw the Canadian Museum of Flight back in Seattle, the Historic Flight Foundation, and the Museum of Flight, which we'll be talking about here in just a second. We also found a couple of aviation-themed restaurants. And we had some adventures with some exotic automobiles as well, but we'll talk about that another time. It was a great trip. I want to thank Tom for the Air Canada flights, Bill for the tour of Victoria, which is what an amazing place. What a great place for a vacation. And, of course, thanks to Isaac. He created the itinerary He also made sure he backed into every parking space until I made a fuss about it. When you pull into a parking space, do you pull in nose first or do you back in? I always pull in nose first.
And I never thought about it a whole lot until I got my single engine seaplane rating with a gentleman down in Florida who was a retired Navy officer. And he commented on how statistically there are fewer accidents for people that pull out as opposed to people that back out. So I hadn't heard that before.
And I lost the habit because I used to drive a wheelchair van with a ramp on the side. So you don't back those in because they always put the wheelchair ramp, the extra space on the right side, the passenger side. So I don't mind you backing in a parking lot, but if it's going to take you 20 minutes to back your car into that spot,
yeah,
just do like the rest of us and just pull in.
Yeah, Isaac likes to back in. But enough of that. So we have a number of interviews, and we'll start with three from the Museum of Flight. And I spoke with Matt Hayes, who's the CEO and president, and with Jeff Nunn. He's the exhibit developer and adjunct curator for space history. They have a Destination Moon exhibition that we'll be talking about in just a minute here. And I also spoke with Amy Heydrich, who's the director of collections, and learned some interesting things about how collections are preserved. And so we'll have those. So why don't we start first with Matt Hayes, the CEO and president of the Museum of Flight. I told him before we started that I want to kind of talk about the soul of the museum. I remarked that in visiting all of these different museums over the years, each one of them is different in some way. And it may be because of, you know, what the displays are, what the exhibits are, or where it's located, or whatever. And so in this conversation with Matt, you'll hear us talking about what is it that kind of defines the character of a museum. So let's jump right in. This is Matt Hayes, CEO and president of the Museum of Flight. I'm here at the Museum of Flight with Matt Hayes. He's the president and CEO of the Museum of Flight. Matt, it's wonderful to meet you and to be back at the museum again.
Oh, it's great to have you here, Max, and then show you around a little bit. We're pretty excited to have you here.
I was last here for Aviation Geek Fest back in, well, I think it was 3 years ago,
That sounds about right.
I was really impressed with the museum then, and I'm really happy to be able to spend a little bit more time on this visit with the museum. But you're the president and the director, the CEO.
Yes.
And you're not just some sort of administrator that doesn't really have much of an attachment to aviation. You have kind of a lifelong attachment, I think.
Well, absolutely. Like so many of your listeners, I grew up with a love for aviation. I grew up in the rural areas of Western New York and stood, unfortunately, probably under the crop dusters as they went overhead and watched them come up with corn stalks in their wheels. And that was pretty much enough to ignite the excitement for me. So I was flying, working three farm jobs, was flying by the time I was 16. Took up history and accounting, of all things, in university, and got into the for-profit world for a while before I moved on to becoming a volunteer here at the museum, and that's how I got my start.
And you were doing some restoration work.
I was. I got started on our B-17F model, and as like any great new young volunteer should, working with Rosie the Riveters and with original engineers and pilots of the B-17, I was cleaning bird dew off the tail and vacuuming the really uncomfortable places. But sooner or later, they taught me how to rivet, to bend some sheet metal, to read the drawings, and did that for 9 full years until we had to move it out of Plant 2 where it was originally constructed back in the 40s.
What kind of condition was it in? Where did it come from?
It's got a wonderful history. It's got a Hollywood history because it flew in Tora, Tora, Tora. It flew in Memphis Belle. It was one of those great Hollywood tricks where they painted it half one set of numbers on one side, half on the other side. But it flew during World War II as well. We do know it made it up to England. It didn't fly in combat. because they had the G models out by then. So it came back from England, flew as a trainer. And since then, it has been a fire bomber. It had spread pesticides. It had been used in air shows, everything, until a great volunteer purchased it and eventually donated it to the museum.
Fantastic. How many people worked on that restoration?
Oh, my goodness. It was almost a two-decade restoration, yeah. Completely 100% volunteer-based restoration. And it's probably the most accurately put together B-17 in the world right now. And it did fly to get it to its current location, but we've since mothballed it.
Yes, yes. Well, that's it's so important to preserve those kinds of aircraft, historic aircraft. Of course, it's silly for me to say that to somebody who operates a museum like this, but it's just so I don't know. It's just so important work, really, to do, and for you to kind of get into the restoration directly yourself, it probably gave you an appreciation for things that help you in your job now.
Absolutely. And one of those big appreciations, which I didn't think about when I volunteered and started doing that, was the people you get to work with. We have over 100,000 hours of donated time here at the museum every year. And some of those are restoration, some of those are docents, some people work in the administrative offices, some are teaching. But I got to learn – I always say I learned a lot more about life restoring that aircraft than I ever did about a piece of aluminum. And so when you're the hands of a World War II bombardier and be able to get in the engine as he's describing at age 90, if you're talking to a Rosie the Riveter who was talking about how she was procuring and literally bucking rivets in her day, you learned a lot about not just the aircraft, but the relationships and the history and the deep and rich history that goes beyond the things you traditionally see in the books.
Talking with people like that who have those experiences, who were part of that kind of history, it's important to capture that as well. And don't you have some kind of a program or project for oral histories?
We absolutely do. We've got a wonderful Mike and Mary Kay Hallman oral history program here where we get a lot of the people that are known in the history books. You know, we get the Apollo astronauts and we get the fighter aces from the Korean War. But we also get some of those folks that may have developed a dial that was on the Apollo capsule, or a flight attendant who was the first woman flight attendant on whatever airline, and telling her stories. It is such a rich environment to hear of stories. And this museum is all about relationships, and it's all about hearing the people's stories. And when people walk away from our 175 aircraft and spacecraft, a lot of times they remember what they learned about a human being or a human being they met here.
Mm-hmm. So how do you capture that?
Well, that part of the way we do it through oral histories.
Yes.
And so those are fully transcribed and made available to the public. So you can go on our internet at museumofflight.org and read those transcripts and professionally done. But we try to capture that in our exhibitry. So it is more than how high, how fast, those were the things that enthralled me when I was a kid, But that's not a way to get the general public. And we continue that through our education programs, where now we can get young girls, young boys excited about and inspired about a program, and then give them something to do with it by meeting mentors that flew, by meeting the first female 747 pilot and having her say, "You too can do this," looking at a young seventh grader.
Right. I was commenting earlier before we started recording that when Isaac and I pulled into the parking lot, there were a number of school buses here, and we've seen a lot of youngsters in the museum, which is very encouraging.
It absolutely is. We have about 180,000 kids that go through this museum every year, and more than half of them come through some structured program. And what we've tried to do is go beyond the traditional museum model of inspiring people through wonderful field trips, which we do very well and we have done for decades. But now to have a continuum of learning and programs that get increasingly rigorous, that give kids a chance to do project-based learning, have mentors, do field trips out to other locations, and eventually get formalized high school and college level credit here, right here at the museum.
So do you have good relationships with some of the local elementary schools, or I'm not sure what you call them here in this area, intermediate schools?
Sure. We have all the ages. We do pre-K. We have STEM starters for pre-K kids. We have 3D printing classes. We actually have Razorback Aviation High School on our campus. It's a public school, top school in the state right now, from one of the most diverse zip codes in the country. But it's all based on the same objective: get people prepared and excited about these fields, and then give them some way to be prepared.
Now, today when I walked into the museum, the main area of the museum, I remembered what I felt about it when I was here last, which is that it's a large space with a lot of glass and well lit. Oftentimes you see museums that are kind of dim and it's hard to sort of see things. But this has a different feel to it. And I was thinking about all the different aviation museums I've been to in the last few years, which is if I counted them up, I think it'd be quite a lot. But each one is different in some way or another. It's got a different feel to it. And it might be because of the types of exhibits or what is exhibited or the strategy or philosophy of the people that are operating the museum. Each one sort of has its own kind of characteristic. So I was interested in asking you, Matt, what do you think is the important characteristic or aspect of this museum, the Museum of Flight, and how do you kind of create that feeling?
That's a great question, Max. I think, you know, I although we do have that large collection and probably in many ways are the largest non-governmental aviation museum in the world, it really comes down to the people and the stories that we tell. We've got over 50 years of history now. And so and it's a place that's embedded and imbued with that history. We know the people that helped start this place. We have the stories that go on in oral lore that, you know, it's almost like hangar flying in the museum world so often. And so as strange it is to talk about a place that's based on objects and based on artifacts and based on paper and photographs to say that's the people that are the soul. But you can almost feel the presence once you've been here a while of not just the aviation luminaries, the space luminaries, but the people that helped design that wonderful glass building. You know, they've sent family members back here to see what the original architects have done. We have people that have exhibit portfolios from the early days and exhibits that don't even exist anymore. And they've come back with scrapbooks about the exhibits they've done. We like to be a convener in this community of not just people from 50 years ago, like the Tuskegee Airmen and whatnot, but at current AOPA groups of FAA groups, but also of the new space, Blue Origin, and we have new space discussions here. We want to be a community asset where people come, and so. As strange as it is, it really is our soul of the museum, both past, present, future, is people and relationships.
And this area, of course, has so much of that. I mean, with Boeing and with all the other companies, aviation, aerospace, space companies that are in this area, all the employees in that industry that live here, of course, with their families and all, people who've worked in those companies in the past and are maybe retired now. Sure. It's sort of part of what this town is all about.
Absolutely. And it starts with our largest artifact, which is the Red Barn, which is where the original Boeing factory. And so if you want to talk about the soul, I mean, when you talk about what is the original soul of this museum, all you have to do is sit in there and have a dinner or sit and talk on a quiet night and you can hear the boards creak and you can smell the wood and you can smell the woodworking machines and it feels very real. And so if there's any beating soul, beating heart of a museum, especially in Boeing country, where we're surrounded by Boeing, it is that Red Barn, and it is a great representation and a very real representation of what aviation is all about.
Yes. Now, another thing that we saw when we came in, actually Isaac took me to show me, was a memorial where there's a B-52 up on stands. Tell us a little bit about what that area is all about.
Yeah, this is a great story. We had our own B-52 that was part of the SALT II, then START I treaty. When they chopped a bunch of them up in the desert after that treaty got signed, 10 were made available to the public. They had to be seen by satellites by the Soviets and then shortly by the Russians after that. So unfortunately, it kind of got lost at our restoration facility up in Everett, north of Seattle. And it sat up there for a couple decades, rather forlorn, had to be moved around a lot, had to call the Pentagon initially if we wanted to move it even 10 feet. And then we had a reunion of one of the crews that flew that in Vietnam. And all five of them were around. One of them lived here locally. And we decided, well, we're going to try to save the aircraft and more importantly, do more than that. And so the idea of Project Welcome Home started, where we could find a way to say thank you to veterans and welcome them home properly, and whether those were that were able to return as well as those that weren't. So we put together a wonderful park in our last bit of green space. And this is one of those rare projects. It wasn't for the museum. It really was for the community, especially the veterans community. And we couldn't be prouder or more excited to open it up on May 25th. We're going to have General Jim Mattis here, along with a number of other great people, flybys with growlers and the Cascade Warbirds, and going to have a Cobra and a Huey landing right in the area and flying up the river. But most importantly, it's that welcome home aspect. This park wasn't for us this time. It wasn't a museum thing. This is going to be open to the public for free. And we want as many people to come at 11 o'clock in the morning on the 25th and forever thereafter.
And I can tell you that already there are some veterans who are stopping by, even though the finishing touches are still underway. I saw several that it's kind of moving because when you look at the expression on their face, you know, mm-hmm. sort of gazing up at this B-52, you can tell that this is something that's really meaningful to them. It's pretty impressive.
But, yeah, we spent much of 2018 not only revamping our Vietnam-related exhibits and collecting new things for the collection, but having some of those conversations and just mm-hmm. inviting people that were affected, impacted by that conflict to come to the museum and have those conversations. We learned a lot, and we learned there's a lot of places that haven't been as open to have that conversation. It's not always easy, but again, we couldn't be prouder to be the home mm-hmm. of that.
Now, you're a pilot yourself. Do you still have time to fly these days?
The last couple of years, it's been hard. I owned a little 150 for 15 years, and you don't mind going low and slow when you live in the Pacific Northwest. Yeah. There are so many mountains, waters, everything. So, yeah, and you got to float fly around here, of course.
Yes, yes. I've taken one trip, and I've seen so many of the local companies with the float planes. It's an interesting area, unlike any other that I've seen before. I mean, I'm sure there are others, but I had not been in a place where there was so much water and so much of the local transportation model was based around flying. It's really kind of remarkable.
Oh yeah, it's. I'm very biased, and it's the most beautiful place I can imagine to fly is the Pacific Northwest. Yes.
All right. Well, Matt, anything that's coming up in the future for the museum that we haven't touched on? I mean, we've talked about several things, but anything that's down the road, coming years?
Well, the one thing that's going on right now is we have the Destination Moon exhibition with the original Apollo 11 capsule and about 20 wonderful artifacts from the Smithsonian Air and Space Museum mixed in with our own exhibits and our own items. So that's open as of today, and we'll be 7 days a week until September 2nd. So we're excited to be in host of the Holy Grail, especially on the 50th anniversary of the moon landing. So the days surrounding July 20th, you can expect there's going to be a lot of wonderful things happening here at the museum. But probably near and dear to your heart, as soon as that closes, we'll be opening up a propulsion exhibit. Mm. And so we'll get back into our more aviation-related items and a wonderful lineup over the next couple of years, including Disney at War and maybe some other really exciting things.
Oh, fascinating. All right. Well, I'll definitely have to come back. This is such a great area to come to if you're an aviation enthusiast. Anyway, there are so many things to see and do around here. So I want to thank you, Matt, for spending a few minutes with our audience. And tell everybody where they can learn more about the museum, the projects, the exhibits, and all.
Wonderful. Besides coming here, you can always go to Museum of Flight, all smushed together, .org. Not only we learn about the calendar and the exhibitions, but you also learn how to get access to our collection, 4 million items strong, and our education programs, which we think are a hallmark of what we do here at the museum. So museumofflight.org.
Excellent. Thanks again, Matt.
Yep. Thank you, Max.
All right. Next up, Jeff Nunn. Again, he's the exhibit developer and adjunct curator for space history. The Destination Moon exhibition, again, is celebrating the 50th anniversary of the landing on the moon on July 20th. And here is my conversation with Jeff.
I've been with the Museum of Flight as an exhibit developer since 2010 and then was promoted to space curator in 2014 after the installation of our shuttle exhibit, which was an exhibit that I worked as primary research lead on for in an exhibit capacity.
Okay.
So I grew up a NASA brat. So
did you?
Yes. Yeah, I had family worked on shuttle and actually on Apollo. And so I spent my very early childhood in and around JSC. And so I would, you know, when I was in preschool, I was getting behind the scenes tours and very likely set foot in some of the, in like the full fuselage trainer that we have here at the museum as part of those tours that my family were involved with. So
you got the bug from a really, really early age.
Yes, absolutely. So in that sense, kind of came on from an interesting perspective. A lot of folks who work in aviation museums have backgrounds in aerospace engineering or are pilots or otherwise professionally engaged in aviation. My professional training is in museums, but I come at it as an aviation and space just super fan.
So, yeah, were you always a super fan? Did you want to be an astronaut someday? Or
I mean,
at a really young age?
I'm certain that at some point there was that desire. And looking back at various things, you know, what I read as a kid, the movies I liked, I used to draw a lot. And going back through my sketches, it's like, space was sort of this underlying theme that just sort of bubbled beneath the surface since I was a kid.
Yeah, so you must love working here at the museum now. So tell us a little bit about the exhibit, the space exhibit that's here.
Yeah, so we have a traveling exhibit from the Smithsonian called Destination Moon, and it is their exhibit celebrating the 50th anniversary of the Apollo 11 moon landing, which is this summer. And we are incredibly fortunate to be the host venue for this traveling exhibit over the 50th anniversary on July 20th. So we will have all of a lot of the most important artifacts from the Apollo 11 moon landing here in Seattle for the 50th anniversary. So it's really incredible.
And some of these artifacts are pretty impressive. One that that is sort of in the beginning parts of the exhibit when you enter is the lunar rover. Or this is an engineering prototype, is it, of the rover?
Yeah. So the traveling exhibit really focuses on Apollo 11, and the rover, which is part of our collection, did not fly on Apollo 11. They weren't used until the last three missions. And we had it on display as part of our own permanent space exhibit. And when we started working on this, the folks from the Smithsonian said, well, you're going to have to figure out what to do about the rover because it's, you know, this is an Apollo 11 exhibit and there were no rovers on Apollo 11. Well, the rovers were made here in Seattle. So one of the big things we decided to do was to highlight those local contributions. And so we recontextualized the rover from the space story to the Washington story. Mm-hmm. It was built just south of the museum in Kent, Washington. And so we used it as really an anchor artifact in a sort of prelude section of the exhibit all about Washington goes to space.
Right. So, yes. There's sort of a progression as you go through the exhibit. Mm-hmm. I mean, there's a flow. It's not just an open area where you can see every aspect of the exhibit and then wander to whichever part that you're interested in. There is kind of a directed flow, and I like the aspect that you mentioned where bringing the local context to the whole thing is a big part of that, which is, I'm sure that's particularly interesting to the people who are from this area, but it's just interesting in general as well.
Well, yeah, and a lot of folks think the space program, you know, when you think the space program, it's like, okay, well, there's Houston, because everyone knows Mission Control is in Houston, and there's Kennedy Space Center where we launch the rockets. And if you're a little bit more of a fan, you know, Huntsville, Alabama built the rockets. But a lot of, you know, there were 400,000 people working on this effort to get us to the moon, and they came from all across the country. And a lot of the host venues for this exhibit have all told their local story, and Washington State was absolutely a integral in the process of getting us to the moon. And so we really wanted to highlight all of, and well, there was no way we could highlight all of those stories, but as many of those stories as we could.
Probably the largest maybe component or artifact in the exhibit is the F1 engine. That thing is enormous.
Yeah, and we have two of them. The exhibit is on display in the same space as our permanent Apollo exhibit, which we opened in 2017. And then we pulled a lot of the components out for that. But some key elements were definitely left in place. And one of those is a display about the F1 engine. And we have basically two engines. I sometimes refer to them as our before engine and our after engine. And the before engine is on loan from Marshall Space Flight Center. And it was actually originally mounted on the first stage of Apollo 16. And there was a fire during the static fire testing for that stage. And so several of the engines caught fire and they had to pull it off. They refurbished it and reassigned it as a flight spare for Apollos 19 mm-hmm. and 20. Well, those missions ended up being canceled. It went into storage for a long time and then was brought actually back down to Huntsville for when they were starting to ramp up SLS. They were thinking about, okay, are we going to use Apollo era hardware? Are we going to use shuttle era hardware? So they ran some tests on it, but it was sitting in this hangar when we were working on the Apollo exhibit, and one of our board members found it, and we worked with Marshall and got it up here and managed to very carefully get it into the gallery. And that was on display alongside our other F1 engine, which we call our after engine, which is it's actually cobbled together from several of the components that Bezos Expeditions brought up from the bottom of the Atlantic Ocean. So it's a mix of hardware from Apollo 12 and Apollo 12 and 16. So we have a thrust chamber from Apollo 12, along with a lot of the associated components, and a heat exchanger from Apollo 16. So we've got those telling the story of the engine and the recovery effort, which is really kind of the latest adventure in this journey to the moon. We have a journey both to the moon as well as down to inner space, to the bottom of the ocean, to retrieve these artifacts. So the exhibit really goes all the way from Sputnik in the early days of the space race all the way up to the 20-teens.
When Matt and I were walking through the exhibit, he mentioned the power in just the fuel pump in that F1 engine. Mm-hmm. He said that somebody, I don't know, maybe that was you, somebody here at the museum did some calculations and learned that the horsepower essentially of that fuel pump on the F1 engine is greater than the combined thrust of all of the aircraft in the collection. It's just some amazing physics going on in these engines.
Yeah. It was not me, but the back of the napkin math was that the engine as a whole was more powerful than everything. But the fuel pump is still really impressive. It's something like 20 or 30,000 pounds of thrust, I think, just going through the fuel pump alone. And then you've got 1.5 million for the engine as a whole.
Right. So. Well, we'll get to the centerpiece of the exhibit, the capsule, the Apollo 11 capsule itself. But first, there are some other items in the exhibit that are of kind of a more personal nature to the astronauts.
Yeah, absolutely. So among other things, going back to the local story, we have Dick Gordon, who was the command module pilot on Apollo 12, was local. He grew up in Kingston, Washington, north of Seattle and across a ferry ride. And we have his Gemini 11 flight suit. And then we also have some items from the Armstrong family. We have a good working relationship with the Armstrongs. And they lent us some of Neil Armstrong's personal effects. And it's really, they selected them and said, here, we'd like to put these on display. And it was a really interesting mix of items from his astronaut career as well as just from his personal life. So among other things, there is his Congressional Space Medal of Honor. Mm. Which was the very first such award given to an astronaut and the only one given for a moon landing. And we have that on display alongside his euphonium. He was a brass player all the way back to high school when he and his I guess you'd call him a jazz quartet, the Mississippi Moonshiners, would play before assemblies. And we have that along with several musical programs that he was involved with, both all dating all the way back to high school as well as when he was in at university at Purdue, on display, that really kind of captured this more personal side of of Neil Armstrong and were selected by his family of saying, this is Dad. And and then the other big one is an official NASA flight suit that was presented to, or that was part of Neil Armstrong's officially sort of designated wardrobe that didn't quite fit him. It was a little too big around the waist, a little too short in the legs. And so the family nicknamed it the short, fat flight suit. And he wouldn't wear it for NASA duties because it didn't fit, but it became the whole family's preferred coveralls around the farm in Ohio.
Right.
So it's got paint stains and grass stains on it. But it's just this really interesting blend of astronaut and Ohio farm boy.
Yes, yes. The capsule itself, of course, is large and probably difficult to transport. And that's on loan from the Smithsonian.
Correct.
And how was that transported here?
Well, I'm actually not at liberty to dive into details. It's actually, you know, this is a national treasure. I think there was actually, in the wake of the Notre Dame fire that happened, someone wrote an article that talked about what are the 10 greatest artifacts of human history that are still in existence. And the Apollo 11 command module was one of them.
Interesting.
And so the security around its transport is incredibly tight. I can tell you it was transported by land, but that's about all the detail that I can go into. Down to, you know, there are only a couple of people who know when it's in transit in the entire country, and I am not one of them because I don't need to know. So, and I'm actually kind of grateful not to have that burden. So
that's right.
But that it was really fascinating to work on that because in a lot of ways, there are only a couple of people here at the museum that knew when to expect its arrival. And so they would disseminate it to the folks who would need to prep and be able to get it in here. And getting it into the gallery space was a challenge in its own right. That
I imagine.
Yeah. Because if you've been here to the museum, it had to come in and go kind of across a couple of different levels. So it involved, you know, constructing ramps and things of that sort just to get it into the gallery.
Mm.
So,
and Jeff, for people that come to see the exhibit, what do you hope that they take away from it?
Yeah, so when we were first really kind of thinking about this exhibit and who is it for and what is it about and what are anniversaries about? And we really settled on the exhibit is really intended to be intergenerational. It's intended for those who were either worked on the Apollo program or who where it had an influence in their life. They remember being children sitting in front of their televisions in the living room, watching this grainy feed come back and Walter Cronkite, this person who was, you know, known for being the voice of American news, being rendered speechless by this moment.
Yeah, yeah.
It's a chance for them to remember, but then it's also a chance to inspire that next generation. We're at a really interesting moment in space history right now where activity is ramping up again and there's talk of going back to the moon, and it's feels in a lot of ways like almost like post-World War I aviation and the barnstorming days where the baton is being handed off from government to private industry, and private industry is trying to figure out, okay, what are our missions with this? You know, NASA likes to say, well, we never built we don't build our rockets. That's always been private industry. But now they're not just building it. They're actually running their own missions.
Yes.
So, yeah.
And there's a lot of that in this area, of course.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's the other big thing here is that, you know, this exhibit really focuses on Seattle's role in the early space race with our Washington Goes to Space. But we are still very much, and perhaps even more so, a hot spot for space development. And we've got folks like Blue Origin in town. We've got Aerojet Rocketdyne, which has been here since the 50s in the form of Rocket Research Lab. That is every single space probe from the U.S. that's out there pretty much is guided by thrusters built in Redmond, Washington. And so
there's kind of a new optimism, I think, amongst many people, myself included, who, like you say, remember those those days in front of the the TV set, the grainy picture, and Walter Cronkite and all that have kind of lamented for some time that we haven't been all that active in terms of manned space exploration. Although we do have some pretty spectacular rovers and flybys and, you know, unmanned spacecraft performing some really interesting things and bringing back some fascinating science as well as images and all. But it kind of feels like maybe we are moving towards a time when there is more active manned space exploration. Whether we go to the moon next or Mars next or, you know, where we go. What do you think? Are you feeling that kind of optimism yourself?
Yeah, there's definitely a lot of optimism there, and there's a lot of excitement. And one of the things that I often think about is it feels like the ecosystem is healthier when it comes to space exploration. And I think a lot of that has to do with we're not putting all of our eggs in one basket. Hmm. You know, during Apollo, it was early Apollo. I mean, there was also X-15 and Dinosaur and MOL and all that, but ultimately there was only this one survivor that kind of became that thread of human exploration from NASA. But now we have multiple launch vehicles, we have multiple cargo contracts, we have multiple crew vehicles in development, and I think that is important. And one of the things I often go back to that's not just, it is related to human spaceflight is 2015. It was a really bad year for a lot of these launch companies. We had something, there were multiple rocket failures for rockets that service the International Space Station. And there was a lot of talk about, are we going to have to pull the crew from the station? But because we had these multiple different vehicles all servicing it, we were able to shift those cargo deliveries in order to keep the station running, which would never have happened if it had just been Shuttle. If Shuttle had another failure and was still flying in 2015, it would have been probably game over for the space station. But we were able to keep it resupplied. And that, you know, it was kind of a stress test of that logistics system. And that I hope that the industry can take as a, and that the government can take as a lesson of why it's so important not to just have a single system for all of our exploration.
Yes. So. Excellent. All right. Exciting times. Mm-hmm. Jeff Nunn, thank you so much for spending a few minutes with our audience. It's fascinating. Great exhibit. I think it looks like it's going to be a great success. When did it open?
So the exhibit opened officially on April 13th. We had a public preview for Yuri's Night on April 12th, and it is open now, running through the summer until September 2nd, just after Labor Day.
Excellent. Thanks again, Jeff.
Thank you.
Now, that Destination Moon exhibition, again, it runs through September 2nd, 2019. And this is something that's really well worth seeing if you're near the Museum of Flight or if you're in another location where this traveling exhibit is going to be displayed. That Apollo 11 capsule, when you walk up to it, when you see it, it's just to look at this thing and look at the condition that it's in and think about, you know, three human beings riding in that thing to the moon and back. It's just amazing. And of course, that F1 engine that the Museum of Flight has is just enormous. And, you know, when you see that thing towering over you, it's fun to kind of imagine the rest of the rocket, the Saturn rocket that rose up over that. It's just really spectacular. So next we have Amy Heidrich, the Director of Collections. Amy Heidrich is Director of Collections here at the Museum of Flight. Amy, welcome to the Airplane Geeks podcast. What is a Director of Collections?
So I am in charge of the staff that cares for the museum's collection. And so my role focuses on everything that's in our library, archives, and small objects collection. We do have a director of aircraft collections who's in charge of taking care of our aircraft.
So What does it mean to take care of the collection? I mean, brush the dust off, or what does that mean?
A little bit of that. And mostly what we are entrusted with is making sure that everything within the museum's collection is preserved, cared for appropriately, meaning that it's housed in proper enclosures. If it's not something on exhibit, we want to make sure that it is in acid-free boxes and it's in a climate-controlled environment and that it's not deteriorating. So our goal is really to preserve the collection for posterity and to do whatever we can to slow the natural decay of some materials in the collection, and then to make sure that everything that is on exhibit is properly displayed, and that it's not receiving, you know, too much sunlight, or you know, if it does have dust, we would clean dust, and you know, to make sure that everything is protected and safeguarded.
So the requirements for protecting and safeguarding mm-hmm. different items would tend to depend on what they're made out of, right?
Yes,
so paper
absolutely.
Would have one kind of characteristics when mm-hmm. it comes to preservation, mm-hmm. aluminum, something else.
Yeah. So every material has different requirements in terms of storage parameters if it's something that's not on exhibit, and then also when it is on exhibit. You know, light is really, really damaging to a lot of materials, in particular paper, of course. Mm-hmm. Any sort of inks and dyes can often fade, but whereas something like metal doesn't really suffer the same effects in the same ways. So there are different parameters for all different types of materials. And so we have paper-based things, we have fabric-based things, lots of uniforms, the metal objects, tools, equipment, that sort of thing. All of it has different parameters in terms of storage and care.
I was at another museum a few days ago, and one of the exhibits was a fabric-covered mm-hmm. airplane. And I touched the fabric, and the docent who was there got very upset with me for that. And, there was
yeah.
no barrier. The nice thing was there was no barrier, so you could get right up to the aircraft on display. But the downside was you could also touch it.
Yes, we do not encourage touching of museum artifacts, and and usually museums put barriers in place, but every museum is different. But my favorite sort of example of why you shouldn't be touching things in museum exhibits was something that I learned about many years ago in grad school. There was a museum that had a metal sheet up, and they encouraged people to touch it. And they had plex over one side so that you couldn't touch it, but then the other side was exposed, and they encouraged you to touch it. And so over the years,
yes.
you could see what the deterioration did from all of that repeated touching, the oils in people's hands, and how it completely corroded eventually over time the metal. So,
that's fascinating.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's a great demonstration.
It
I mean,
is.
That kind
is.
Of drives the point home
mm-hmm.
to, you know, don't touch these things.
Don't touch it. Yeah.
Have you ever run across any items here in the collection that were unexpectedly deteriorating?
You know, one of the things that we have noticed over time is some of our leather flight jackets, in particular this kind of standard Air Force brown leather jacket that so many servicemen had. You know, they obviously, a lot of them are painted or embroidered and the patches and things, but they also used obviously some sort of leather conditioner at some point in their life. And what we have noticed is that over time, that conditioner is kind of emerging on the surface as a white sort of bloom. It's very interesting, and that is something that was really unexpected, and we've had to talk to conservators about that.
So do you have a preservative that you would otherwise use for leather?
We try not to add anything to the leather because it's easier to preserve in its natural state, because you never know how those conditioners are going to play over time. And the other thing that's really interesting about flight jackets that is difficult to care for is the metal on the zipper often corrodes as well. And so you've got a different play of with the leather, and then different kinds of fabric usually around the zipper, and then the zipper itself. There's so many different components, and they don't play very nicely together over time. So.
Would you put some kind of a waxy material over zippers, metal zippers?
No, but we have seen that before, and then we tend to try to remove it, because that is what helps aid the corrosion, is that the corrosion is actually building up in all of that sort of waxy material that Let's put over the zippers.
You see, Amy, I'm kind of looking for some tips for my stuff at home. Not,
yes.
You know, right?
Oh,
for,
absolutely. Yes.
And kind of what I'm getting is part of it is not to introduce other.
Yeah, not to introduce other things. And then also to make sure that you can provide little buffers in between certain types of things. So if you can, you know, enclose like the zipper with some sort of acid-free tissue so that it's not touching anything else on the jacket, that sort of thing. We recommend not storing things on hangers, if at all possible, rather than in boxes, ideally stuffed with acid-free tissue so you kind of holds their shape. In particular, leather items are really challenging.
Amy, how did you learn all these things?
So I went to grad school for museum studies.
Oh.
And there's a number of tracks that you can follow when you're studying to work in museums. A lot of people might go into development, which is the fundraising aspect. Some people might go into education. But my track was always collections care. That was always what I was really passionate about, is actually working with objects. And so that was what I focused my studies on.
Where did that interest come from?
So I was a history major as an undergrad, and I actually interned at Evergreen Aviation down in McMinnville when I was a senior in college. And it kind of introduced a new track for me that related to history that I was not aware. When you're a history major, there's only a limited number of things you can do with a history degree. You can go to law school or you can teach history. And those seemed to be what everyone else was doing. And neither of those really had a strong appeal for me. So what I really wanted to do was actually work more closely with products of history. And so museums seemed like a really natural fit, is that I actually get to work with historical objects, which is something that really, really interests me.
So did you come to the Museum of Flight in that capacity?
So when I went to grad school here at the University of Washington for the Museum Studies program, I decided I was working at an art museum as well. So I was working, you know, with paintings and ceramics and those types of things. But I really missed what I had experienced working at another aviation museum, which were historical artifacts that were not quite not every photograph is matted and, you know, will be displayed in sort of an art capacity. I really miss kind of sort of the research aspect of the objects in the collection. So I actually started interning here, and I worked here for a number of years while I was in grad school. And then miraculously, after grad school, it turned into a job, and I've been here for 12 years now.
12 years, wow. So, yeah. And I would think that internships would be a good way to get a foot
absolutely.
In the door or started with a museum.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's we have so many interns that that work here, and a number of alums from our graduate program as well that interned here and are still here sometimes, just like me, decades later. So it really is a great vital opportunity to get work experience, hands-on work experience.
Have there been any disasters from a preservation standpoint that you've encountered over those years? Something unexpected?
Or? I'm trying to think of any example. I wouldn't say there's been any disasters, but there are some really strong challenges with a collection like ours. I mentioned the leather flight jackets. A lot of our space artifacts, in particular, you know, like flight suits or even any pressurized pilots, you know, SR-71 pilot, that sort of where they would be in like a pressure suit. Those types of objects really are very, very challenging to take care of because of all of the different plastic and rubber and, you know, all the different fabrics. None of that plays very nicely together. And so that's been one of the bigger challenges that we faced. For a long time, I worked exclusively in the archives and with the archival collection. And I've been amazed at how many challenges we faced with our photographic materials. A lot of our collections, you know, personal photographers had been storing their collections, say, in storage units and, you know, garages and basements. And it's been very interesting to see how being stored in those types of environments for long periods of time, the damage that has rendered on some of the collections in particular, you know, things like curled photos and, and bubbling emulsion on negatives, those types of things. And it really, you know, those lessons, those textbook lessons about why and how these materials deteriorate, when you actually see it physically manifest in a donation, that's over time, which there's very little you can do to correct things that happened 20, 40, 50, 60 years ago. But it's very interesting to see how that manifests after time. You
know? I remember from my old black and white photography days in the darkroom that, there was processing that would get you a nice looking photograph now. And there was something more that would keep that photo in that kind of condition for decades afterwards. And if you didn't take proper care, do proper processing, you get fading or some of these other problems that you've mentioned. Is the collection digitized or being digitized? Is that a solution?
My favorite collection question that I always get is you know, is your collection digitized? Our collection probably has, we estimate, about 4 million images. So prints and negatives. And we, just for fun, a few years ago, we did the math and we determined that if our current staff did nothing but digitize the photographs in the collection, 40 hours a week, you know, 52 weeks a year, it would take 216 years to properly digitize the entire collection. And so the answer to that question is no. And there is, there's always a, there's a saying that people that work with archival materials will say is that digitization is an access medium, not a preservation medium. And so it's really the process of digitizing things is to make sure that they are accessible while you still have to focus on preserving the original, which is vital because you can always go back, you know, there's things called, you know, there's bit rot, there's file degradation, you know, files become unreadable over time. But if you preserve the original, you can always go back and rescan it if you need to. But what we do here is we really, we have for a long time focused on kind of digitization on demand, usually in fulfillment of reference requests. But in the past couple of years, we've had some major digitization grant funded projects. And now we've actually started regular digitization of things that are often requested or like really high use so that we don't always have to pull out the originals. We can provide people with, again, as a, as an access medium, we can provide access to it without having to handle the fragile originals.
Well, just going back to the space exhibit that's here now before we finish up. You mentioned the spacesuits and some of the other items. Were there any other special preservation or protection kinds of measures associated with that exhibit?
Yeah, well, this is a this was a really exciting opportunity for myself and for our collections manager, Sarah. We've been were heavily involved directly with the Smithsonian, the staff, their curators and their object specialists during the whole process of installation and before, and we really learned quite a bit from them about how the Smithsonian cares for these certain objects, things that we're actually going to translate over into caring for our own space objects. But, you know, they have learned a lot of lessons about preserving the spacesuits, about all of the different parameters, the command module itself, all of the different kind of things that it has gone through over its life cycle, you know, the repairs, the rough treatment that it received on its 50 state tour. And so we learned quite a bit from them about exactly how to properly care for these and the environmental requirements that are you know, necessary to display them permanently. So
temperature, and, humidity, things like that.
And how they have established ranges for each of these types of materials based on, you know, kind of the science behind it. There's always parameter, you know, again, a textbook, these are suggested parameters, but they have really gone deeper into that and have very finite requirements for, and they're all different for each case in each object. So it's really fascinating.
Earlier today, when I was talking to Matt, he described how it's almost the differences in temperature or humidity that are important. In other words, when temperature swings,
yes,
you get expansion and contraction, mm-hmm. and similarly with big changes in humidity, mm-hmm. you get the characteristics of the material depending mm-hmm. on the humidity, and it's those kind of changes that can often cause more issues than just the absolute level.
Yeah, absolutely. It's the fluctuations that really really cause the damage. Whereas if you can, there's ranges of temperature and humidity where it should be. But if you sometimes can't even meet that, as long as you can maintain a consistent across the board temperature and humidity, that's better than having it in this very, very precise range. It's really the consistency.
And anything specific about aircraft on display, metal aircraft, let's say, the mm-hmm. side we talked about fabric mm-hmm. we covered before, but for metal aircraft, I don't know. I think maybe the rubber and tires and things would be an issue.
Yeah, there's always things that need to be monitored. Any sort of corrosion around, rivets and joints and all sorts of things that could possibly corrode. We find that our interior, the aircraft inside, of course, are a lot more stable. But with our aviation pavilion, the aircraft are exposed to the elements, and there are a number of issues that come along with that. But we have a great aircraft team who really focuses on keeping those aircraft clean, monitoring the different kinds of corrosion. Another challenge with any aircraft that has actually been used too is the possibility it's next to impossible to get all that oil out. There have definitely been, drips and things over time, but eventually it slows. But all monitoring all of those types of little things, even things like birds, making sure that no birds. Yeah. And that's always a challenge that any museum that has aircraft outside is going to deal with.
Yeah, and just so people know, the pavilion that you mentioned, it's a covered space, mm-hmm. but there are no walls. And it's large. Does that kind of an environment for all those airplanes underneath there make you cringe and hope for something that could enclose
with
them
walls,
someday?
Yes. No, it does. And we're certainly not alone in the challenges of exhibiting aircraft outside. There's so many great museums across this country that are dealing with their own challenges in terms of having aircraft outside. And I don't think there's, given how large aircraft are, it's not always possible to have them all inside, and it provides its own set of challenges. And yes, as a collections professional, it does make me cringe.
Yes, yes.
But it does. It is nice that we do have them at least under cover from the top.
Yes.
That protects, from direct rain, direct moisture. So it does provide some protection.
All right. Well, Amy, very interesting. This is an aspect of aviation museums that I don't think we've really talked about in the mm-hmm. past. So I think our listeners will find this very fascinating. So again, thank you so much for spending
You're very welcome.
The time. Thank you.
Thanks.
We do have one more interview. This is with Isaac Alexander. And Isaac and I talk about our tour of Viking Air, talk about the trip in general, some of the museums that we visited, some of the other activities from the week. Viking Air, of course, is a producer of, I call them utility aircraft. They hold the type certificates for the de Havilland Canada aircraft. So we're talking about things like Beavers and Otters and Twin Otters. Also a Canadair water bomber that they're working to produce. Very interesting. So that'll be coming up next episode. Look forward to that.
This is Gary Chambliss with Cashmack Bay Flying Service. We do airplane and helicopter flight training, and when we're not on frequency, we're listening to Airplane Geeks Podcast.
All right, we have a positive airline story of the week. What are we looking at here?
Well, this is kind of a fun story and not your typical airline story, but when I saw it, I thought, man, we really have to talk about it. The headline is, and this comes from TravelPulse.com, United Airlines and Autobahn International team up to save owls in San Francisco. And so it's all about relocating raptors, primarily barn owls, that reside at the airport and then resettling these birds at suitable golf course habitats. Now, it's kind of funny to read this story because I recall a conversation with the airport manager down at the Reid Hillview Airport, and this conversation probably goes back 4 or 5 years ago. But they were actually looking to do the opposite. They had a number of owls that lived on the property there. These were burrowing owls that lived in the ground. And they were looking to get paid by developers who had to relocate burrowing ground owls from development sites where they were planning to put up buildings, but were blocked from doing that because of they'd be disturbing the habitat. Mm. But they were going to offer up their airport as a way to get paid to host these owls. So anyway, the United basically said that this is all part of their commitment to be environmentally conscious, and I thought that was kind of a unique aspect to do.
It's a hoot of a story.
See, yeah, this is a really, really impressive effort on the part of United Airlines and Audubon International. So this is good work.
And they're going to compensate those owls with extra miles as well, too.
Yep.
And I just checked the weather. Evidently, the temperature is dropping down in hell to like sub-zero, because that's the third positive United story we've had tonight.
I know. This is great.
So just thought I'd comment on that.
I think that's the name of a town up in Iceland. I could be wrong, but maybe it's spelled differently.
All right. What's up with the geeks? David, what have you got going on that's new?
Well, I put this up. We brought this up because Max kind of likes it. Being the lonely curmudgeon that I am sitting in the apartment, I decided I needed to have some company. My options as far as pets go are very limited. No dogs in the apartment. Cats are, I'm allergic, but they are a substantial increase in rent on top of food, clothing, etc. So I went out and got myself a betta fish, otherwise known as a Siamese fighting fish. I got myself a small tank. It's only 2 gallons. It's a bachelor size tank. But while I was at the store looking for things to put in the tank so the fish are happy to swim around, lo and behold, there was a crashed P-40. And what's really kind of amazing about it is it's a really good representation of what a P-40E would look like if it sunk to the bottom of the ocean. Well, my betta fish needed a name, so if he's going to be swimming around the P-40 sunk in the water, he got the name of Zeke, because I didn't have enough guts to name him Zero, because I want him to live long and I didn't want him to have confidence issues. So Zeke now is my buddy, and he will have a picture of him in the show notes. But yes, he swims around, and I have a lot of approval from a lot of people. They say he's a very handsome fish. He's a bit of an egotist like me, and and if you're going to be a nav geek and have a fish tank, yeah, you might as well have a crashed airplane sunk in the bottom of it. So my other thing is I'd like to give a shout out to someone from our fellow podcast, Airline Pilot Guy. This weekend, Captain Nick had his retirement party. Max and I were able to meet Captain Nick, believe it or not, last year at Pittsburgh. And right. We had a wonderful time. And he's not going anywhere, but he's stepping down from his flying Airbuses. But he had an amazing career flying for the Royal Air Force, a time in the Royal Australian Air Force. He even flew a Boeing aircraft, but he doesn't want to admit to that. And I'm kind of the same way. It's a McDonnell Douglas airplane, Nick. But I wanted to wish, on behalf of us here at the Airplane Geeks, happy retirement, and hopefully we'll get you on our show the next time you hop the pond.
Very good. Hear, hear. Retirement is great. Let me tell you, I highly recommend it. I just want to mention on my Alaska Air flight, I got to enjoy the Recaro thin seats. Dave, is that the same seat that you you flew in recently or sat in recently?
Yeah, I think that was the one I flew home from.
From Hawaii, right?
From Hawaii, yes.
Yeah, I found them to be very, very comfortable. My only criticism would be that I think the seat bottom is a little short, but I understand why they are, and it kind of makes sense, and it's not a not a huge thing, but I found them to be really, really comfortable. And the Alaska Air flights were great. The service was good. Meals you needed to purchase, but they had a good selection. It was an enjoyable flight. And then, of course, the other thing that I did when I got back from my big trip was the D-Day squadron, which was at the Waterbury-Oxford Airport here in Connecticut. And, of course, we've been talking about that for quite a while now. I got to meet Mo. Mo, you'll recall, was a guest last year talking about the D-Day squadron. And also met quite a number of Airplane Geeks listeners, which was great. Yesterday, as we record this, the 19th of May, they departed Connecticut for the trip across the Atlantic, taking the northern route. And, of course, they're going to assemble with other C-47s, DC-3s, and so forth for DAX over Normandy. Now, if you want to learn more about the D-Day Squadron, their website is just that, ddaysquadron.org. And daxovernormandy.com. That's June 2nd through 9th, 2019. So if you're in England, where are they going? Duxbury, I think. And then they're going to go.
Duxford.
Sorry. Yep. Thanks, David. Duxford. And then they're going to go fly over to France. So there's a lot of activities in Europe over the 75th anniversary of D-Day, and you might want to check out those sites. We'll have some more about that next episode. I've got a whole series of photographs from the event. Put those up in an album, and probably for next episode, make those available. A great time. Also, want to mention just quickly that coming up is the 70th anniversary of the Berlin Airlift. And that follows right after the Normandy celebration or commemoration, let's say. I think the dates for the Berlin Airlift are June 10th through 18th, 2019. And a number of the aircraft from the D-Day squadron are going to take part in the Berlin Airlift event. And one thing that's cool that I learned that during the Berlin Airlift, they wanted to deliver some stuff, something that the kids, that the children in Berlin would appreciate. So they decided on candy. And so they dropped little bags of candy, but they couldn't just throw them out of the airplane. So they had little cloth parachutes, sort of handkerchief-sized parachutes that the candy was attached to. Well, the D-Day squadron had a number of these. It turns out that it was Jelly Belly who was around back then, and it was Jelly Bellies that were dropped for children at the Berlin Airlift. And so the company, Jelly Belly, recreated the packaging, the same packaging they used for the actual Berlin Airlift, and attached those to the little handkerchief-like parachutes that the planes are going to be dropping over the city, I guess, as part of the celebration. So I thought that was pretty interesting. Jelly Bellies.
So now I have to write a whole an article for you on the candy bomber.
The candy bomber. Love to have that.
Okay, I'll add that to the list of things I need to do this week.
Okay, good. Maybe we can do that for next episode. And then Max West. Let's see, you've been to Frederick, haven't you?
Yeah, I've been busy here. Yes, I went to the AOPA regional fly-in, which was about a week and a half ago in Frederick, Maryland. I was giving a presentation out there, which is why they asked me to come out. Got to see a lot of listeners to both of the podcasts, both the Airplane Geeks and Aviation News Talks. So it was fun to meet up with a number of folks. And let's see, they had the C-47 fly over there, so they had six of the C-47s, which then went up your way. And, of course, they had the parachute drop of about 20 or so, maybe a little bit more parachutes with the traditional round chutes, just like on D-Day. So that was kind of fun. And then this week, we have the Collings Foundation in town hanging out at Moffett Field here in my hometown of Mountain View. Last night I was out picking up some takeout food at a Thai restaurant downtown, and lo and behold, I parked right behind their vehicle. I guess they were done giving tours of the B-17 and the B-24 and the B-25 bomber rides and the all those aircraft, and also the P-51 that they have there as well. And they were apparently out for dinner, so I took one of my cards for the Aviation News Talk podcast and scribbled "Welcome to Mountain View" on the back of it and stuck it on the stuck it on the truck. Now that truck had Massachusetts license plates, so I guess that thing goes all over the place in support of the Collings Foundation. Now I looked at their schedule; they're going to be here for a full week, and just as they did last year, they go roaring right over my head. So it's I get to hear the P-51 passing by 7-8 times a day. So as I've commented on Facebook, this could get expensive, but I actually have a fairly busy flying schedule this week. So not sure that I'm going to pop for that ride, but certainly sounds like fun. And anybody in Northern California, they're going to be in Livermore, Concord, Santa Rosa. I think those are all the locations before they move up to Oregon and Washington State and then start moving eastward across to Montana, Nebraska, Chicago, and finally they end up in Maryland, as I recall. So they're going to be busy over the summer months. And the other thing is I once again got to file a near mid-air collision report last week, which is never fun to do that. I'll talk about that in detail this week on Aviation News Talk podcast. But just real briefly, while taking off from Palo Alto, I had a close encounter with a Gulfstream 4 that was headed to Moffett Field, and we had not just one close encounter, but two. So I had two near mid-air collisions with the same aircraft within a very short period of time.
Yikes. So
it's just one of those where you go, how the heck did this happen? You know, two towered airports, everybody presumably in great communication. But this gentleman was doing a circling approach, and he was circling a little wide, almost on top of our airport. So, you know, these things happen, but it's a little scary to be, you know, dodging aircraft in real time in the air.
Yes. You don't want to be doing that too often.
No.
All right, that's it for this episode. Thanks for listening to the Airplane Geeks podcast. You can find us at airplanegeeks.com. Show notes for this episode at airplanegeeks.com/553. Let's tell everybody where they can find us online. Let's start with David Vanderhoof.
You can find me on our Slack list team, and you can join that fun by sending us an email to thegeeks@airplanegeeks.com. You can find me on Twitter at DM Vanderhoof. You can find me staring at my fish here in Fort Washington. You can find me on the Airplane Geeks podcast. You can find me on the UAV Digest with Max Flight on Friday mornings.
All right. And Max Trescott, how about you?
Well, first you can find me out on the ramp at the Palo Alto Airport. So if you're headed out to Silicon Valley between San Francisco and San Jose and you want to go flying sometime this summer, go ahead and ring me up and we can give you a nice tour of the San Francisco Bay Area. And if you're looking for me online, you can find me in all the usual places like Facebook and Twitter. Or if you want to send me an email, just go to aviationnewstalk.com, click on contact at the top of the page, and you can shoot me an email. And if you've got a listener question that you'd like to have answered on Aviation News Talk, just click on listener question. You can record your question and I'll answer it on a future show.
And you can find me on LinkedIn. Just look for Max Flight. David said at UAVDigest.com. Also with Mary Kirby talking about the passenger experience at PaxXPodcast.com. Our outro is by Bruno Massone. You can find more of his compositions that incorporate aviation sounds at BrunoMassone.com. So please join us again next week as we talk aviation on the Airplane Geeks podcast. Bye, everybody.
Keep the blue side up.
Thanks for listening.
Ladies and gentlemen, in a few moments...